This is Bank of Nevada versus Peterson, case number 66568. I want to first express my appreciation to counsel for accommodating the schedule change request and moving this up a bit. We thank you for that. Mr. Stein, are you ready to proceed?
I am.
Okay.
I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if that pleases.
Of course.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Michael Stein with the law firm Snell & Wilmer. Along with my colleague Bradley Austin, we represent Bank of Nevada. We argue that the district court erred when it denied Bank of Nevada's motion for summary judgment and granted Mr. Peterson's motion for summary judgment. We argue this because NRS 40.455 does not apply to junior lien holders in guaranteed deficiency actions filed under NRS 40.495.
Could you clarify a fact for me?
Certainly.
It would help in my assessment of the case. My understanding is that at the ultimate foreclosure sale, the credit bid was $1.4 million. Was that amount in excess of or under the amount that was fully owed on the first deed of the note secured by the first deed of trust?
It was less. Yeah. I believe it was less, but the stipulated fair market value was more than what was owed.
$1,990,000.
A small amount. So they were not sold out, junior. They were junior lien holder.
Well, I guess the question I have is based on the credit bid, is it the contention of the bank that there were still amounts owed, interest, collection costs, on the note secured by the first deed of trust?
Yes.
Okay. So why wouldn't one have to evaluate, at least with respect to those amounts, whether this is a collection effort under LAVI, at least with respect to those sums, versus a junior lien holder collection claim as to the rest? And how much is that residual amount from the credit bid?
The bank held two separate notes, an A and a B, and two separate deeds of trust.
Right.
After the foreclosure, there was still indebtedness owed on the second. The first
and
was.
And do you know what that amount was?
Yes.
But you're saying the first was wholly satisfied.
Correct.
I think he misspoke earlier.
And I apologize if I misspoke, yes. The first was fully satisfied. That's why I indicated.
That's what I'm trying to clarify.
Yes.
Were there collection costs, interest, still owing, or you for which you're seeking recovery on the first?
No.
Or on the A note?
No.
So the first note is fully paid off on the credit bid.
That's correct.
Okay.
But the deficiency arises out of the second.
And only the second, that's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. So the
amount you're trying to collect is only on the B note, for lack of a better term.
That's the precise term. It was called note B.
All right.
That wasn't made up by us. That was actually in the notes.
Okay, so
that's correct.
Go ahead. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Well, I'm happy to clarify that, and thank you for correcting my misstatement to Justice Hardesty. The district court erred for three reasons. First, it used the wrong statute. It used NRS 40.455 instead of the statutory scheme 44631 through 44639 that governs these actions that are brought by a junior. Two, LAVI is not applicable because Bank of Nevada was, in fact, a junior lien holder. Three, Even if LAVI were applicable and the bank was not the junior, the primary concern in LAVI was notice. It's not an issue here because of the fair market value stip in order and for some other reasons I'm going to cover. That stip was entered into for the sole purpose of calculating the deficiency, and the stipulation was entered into before the expiration of 6 months from the time of the foreclosure sale. And because there's nothing that remains other than a mathematical determination, simply subtraction, we ask this court to overturn the district court's judgment and instruct the judge to enter judgment in favor of Bank of Nevada and against Mr. Pearson, with the sole remaining role of the court is to engage in its subtraction calculation and determine if attorney's fees and costs are appropriate. Because the parties agreed to that, the precise amount of the through the fair market value stip in order of the fair market value, we know and knew from the time that stip was entered into the precise amount that's owed. The indebtedness was not disputed. So by way of a brief roadmap, I'd like to cover a few things with you. First, why NRS 455 is not applicable to junior lien owners, as Bank of Nevada is here. And two, why lobby is not applicable to this case, even if Bank of Nevada was not a junior lien holder. NRS 40.
Well, but can we get there for you? It seems to me that Lavi, rightly or wrongly, said, and I was in the dissent, but I didn't carry the day on Lavi. It seems to me that it's interpreting within 6 months after the date of the foreclosure sale, which is a phrase that appears in both 455 and 4639, as meaning that you're going to have a separate either civil action or application. So I'm a little puzzled by your argument that because it's a sold out or because it's a junior lien holder, we should say Lavi simply doesn't apply, because Lavi does make a textual interpretation of that phrase and suggests that you have to start all over again with the either an application or, in this context, a civil action. Do you follow my question?
I do. Lavi addressed only 40.455.
I understand that.
There's a separate carve-out, 44631 through 44639, for juniors. So when Lavi was dealing with the bank, the lender that was in the first position, the language in that statute for which Lavi interpreted as being the affirmative defense is you must file an application within 6 months, and the majority held that that was important because the complaint alone did not put the borrower on notice of this deficiency it was asking for. I think the language...
But the complaint did ask for a judgment for the full amount, so that's a tough argument for you.
With due respect, I disagree. The complaint in Lavi, we reviewed very carefully. It merely said damages in amount in excess of $10,000.
Okay.
Our case is very different. In our case, in paragraph 53 of the complaint, I drafted that complaint and carefully outlined the damages sought were going to be either the difference between the indebtedness and the amount fair market value at the time the complaint was filed, which is provided in the statute under 4495 when you sue a guarantor before foreclosure, or recognizing that a foreclosure could theoretically happen, I also indicated if there's a foreclosure, then the amount of damages will be the difference between the amount of indebtedness and the amount that the property was sold for at the time of that foreclosure sale, or the fair market value back at the time of the complaint, whichever is greater.
And in responding to that pleading, did your opponent join issue with you on the fair market value allegation?
The fair market, I'm sorry, did he do what?
Did your opponent raise an affirmative defense as to fair market value or admit or deny your allegation on that?
I'll check. I will respond to that in my rebuttal, if that would be okay, Justice.
Okay. While we're on this point, the stipulation that was within the 6 months of the foreclosure sale as to fair market value, could you address that as well?
Yes. So the parties would agree to the following, and I think this is very important. Mr. Pearson asked for a jury trial. And I don't think there could be any dispute that the amount of fair market value is a fact issue, viewing appraisers, usually. So, as a quid pro quo for waiving his jury trial debate, we agreed to use his fair market value number. He got a higher number than our appraised value, and in fact, even a higher number than what he agreed to that the property's value was in his own bankruptcy that he had filed. That was filed. It obviously, it didn't go forward. That was the quid pro quo. And we think that's incredibly important because the six-month issue really becomes moot once there's a jury trial demanded on a fact issue that grows out of what is something that rises out of the Constitution for allowing a jury trial, a breach of contract. And that's what this case is about. It all starts with contract law, the guarantee. And that's the only basis upon which you can sue a guarantor that's even one that waived the one action rules of breach of contract claim. It is does provide for statutory provisions, how that goes forward. But the underlying claim has to be a breach of a contract. So that's how that number, that fair market value was arrived at, and why we think that that addresses, even if we were not.
Right, so you have to do the junior lien levy, all of that. You're saying that would constitute an adequate demonstration of notice, which is what levy's addressing?
Correct, even if we weren't. And let's not forget, in addition to the complaint being very different than the complaint filed in lobby, where it outlines, it addresses the very concerns that were articulated by the majority and the minority, which was that the obliger be aware of this potential for deficiency. He was made aware the day he was served with the complaint. But it goes further than that. In the request for exemption from arbitration, we noted that this was a deficiency action. And in the order granting the request for exemption from arbitration, the court noted it was a deficiency matter. In the joint case conference report, which was signed by all parties, the key issue in the case was defined as fair market value. Why? Because that number is only relevant in the deficiency matter. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. McKnight, how are you?
Good. My name is Richard McKnight, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Peterson. I'd like to correct a statement that was made. Mr. Peterson never filed bankruptcy. The owner of the property did, Red Card LLC. I don't see that fact as really having any sway here. However, if you look at the complaint in this matter that was filed by the bank, it's a classic complaint under 40.459. It does not set out that it's a junior deed of trust, although they do mention there's a first and a second. But they rely on 40.555. While the motion for summary judgment was ongoing, they consistently argued that point to the judge. And before I begin, with regard to this jury question, many of the courts in the 8th Judicial District do not permit juries to decide deficiencies. The court decides it, rightly or wrongly. I don't know if you've had that conundrum come up, but their position is you don't get a jury trial for that. So the argument was consistently made that 455 was the statute that governed the time to do this, and it was only after the judge granted the summary judgment against the bank that the bank came back in and said, oh, we're making a motion to alter amend under Rule 59 because really it's 40.4639 that covers this. Well, if you read this complaint in this case, and of course it is a part of the record, if you look at it, you would never think they were suing on a second trust deed. It looks as though they're relying strictly on 455. So my position is that once they decided, whoops, what we have here is the first deed of trust has been paid off, we're dealing with a second, so we better urge that we're governed by 4639. And in my opinion, what they should have done at that point was amended the complaint to say, okay, we've had our sale, and we got X dollars, and that paid off the first, and paid off so much of the second, therefore, you owe a deficiency of X dollars. That was never done. Now, the stipulation, counsel's reading into the stipulation.
But the complaint did allege that it sought, if a foreclosure sale is concluded before judgment is entered, the amount that is the difference between the amount for which the property was actually sold and the indebtedness.
Right. But it references 455, 40.455 consistent.
But the fact of the matter is it's a notice pleading, and it does allege that it will be seeking, if there's a foreclosure sale, a deficiency, correct?
A deficiency on the first, not on the second, because 40.4639, if you look at Chapter 40, there's a whole section for junior lien holders. And my understanding is that the legislature wanted to shorten the time. It used to be, okay, you had 6 years once junior lien holder was sold out, that you had 6 years
but
to bring
it. You in your answer, you asserted an affirmative defense that the fair market value of the property secured exceeds the amount owed. So it
right.
seems to me clear, and I recognize I'm bound by Lavie, so I'm sort of struggling
right.
with this a bit. But it seems to me quite clear that the complaint alleges there's an A note and a B note.
Right.
The complaint alleges foreclosure hasn't occurred, but if it does, we're going to be seeking the deficiency.
Right.
And you in your answer say you can't get more than the extent to which the fair market value of the property exceeds the amount owed.
Well,
so,
right, because I think I probably would have waived that if I hadn't.
Right, but you've completely joined issue on this, and then you go forward and within 6 months of the foreclosure sale enter into a stipulation and order as to what is the fair market value of the property.
Right.
So what are we doing if we're going to say there's a forfeiture of the deficiency because of what? What more should have been done? I mean, Lavie makes clear you don't need...
They should have either filed an application like they did via summary judgment. Or they should have amended the complaint.
Why would they do a summary judgment when they
that's
have a stipulation that says
what they did?
I'm sorry. Let me finish my question if I might.
Sorry.
Why would they do summary judgment if they have a stipulation and proposed order that says the fair market value of the property as of the foreclosure date is whatever it is, $1.9 million?
Exactly. That's exactly my argument. Why didn't they just march into court and say, okay, we've got a stipulation. We've agreed to the fair market value. Here's how much the property brought. So this is what is owed. They didn't do that.
But you stipulated to what was the fair market value.
That's exactly right. But later, they didn't make a motion until after the time expired.
And the
The
2015 legislature makes this beside the point. I get that the statute doesn't apply retroactively, but we're dealing with rearview mirror law.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
I had a question, Mr. McKnight, and I wanted Mr. Stein to address this question as well. As near as I can tell, the singular difference between 455 and 4639 is the use of the word application in the one and
right.
civil action in the other.
Right.
I'd like both of you to comment on whether that makes a difference in whether Lavie applies or not.
Okay, well, I also make an argument that when they foreclosed, they combined both their first and their second into one note and deed of trust, and therefore they were governed as though they were a first deed of trust, and
mm-hmm.
Lavie applies and 455 applies. Now, I researched and researched, and I could not find a case on that subject, probably because the factual basis is so odd. It's odd for the bank to have two notes, foreclose them both. Why didn't they just foreclose the first?
Let me offer this hypothetical. Suppose in this case we were dealing with an institution that had a first deed of trust.
Right.
And another institution, completely separate,
right.
that had a second deed of trust.
Correct.
Hypothetically, and this is, I think, is critical to the issue about whether how you address application in the one context and civil action in the other.
Right.
Could the holder of a junior lien holder
right.
file a pre-foreclosure complaint before there's been a foreclosure of either the first or the second under 4639?
I believe they could, but then they would have to file a civil action They would have to either amend their complaint or make a motion alerting.
My question is, specifically under 4639,
yes.
Could the holder of a second,
yes.
Including, which would include one that is secured by a deed of trust,
right.
File a pre-foreclosure collection complaint and stand on that complaint under 4639. 4639 does not seem to require a separate application. In Lavey, in Walters, but particularly in Walters, we said that a summary judgment motion filed in an existing case
right.
constituted the application,
right.
which would seem to suggest that at least in the context of the junior lien holder plaintiff,
right.
they can file, as you acknowledged a moment ago,
right.
a pre-foreclosure complaint, and that seems to satisfy the expectation of the language in 4639, does it?
Well, I don't think so, because the legislature was concerned about shortening time that you could keep a second trustee obligor on the hook. And if you had to just file a complaint and then it was foreclosure and then you just sit there and never make an application, you've accomplished your purpose of stretching it out to the time that hopefully the obligor has some money.
Well, but why would they make reference? There's a differentiation between application in the one statute and civil action in the junior lien holder statute.
Right.
And appropriately or not, we have to assume there was some thought behind that, some deliberate,
right.
conscious thought.
Correct.
So do you think that the legislature really meant if a junior lien holder files a pre-foreclosure complaint and then forecloses his junior lien,
right.
let's say the first was nominal and the second was the big one,
right.
That he has to then file a separate civil action after he...
No, not separate.
I mean, that literally, that's what you're saying, to satisfy 4639.
No, he's already got a complaint on file. He amends and he says, okay, the foreclosure took place. This is how much the property brought at foreclosure. Therefore, you owe me X dollars. Or at a minimum...
Where do you get that textually out of the statute that he has to do that in the pure junior lien context that Justice Hart is...
Suppose they had sued Mr. Peterson for something related to the business he was operating.
No, let's keep it really simple.
Okay.
I'm the second deed of trust holder. I'm not the first deed of trust holder.
Right.
And Mr. Peterson borrowed $2 million, and right. it's secured by a second deed of trust. The second deed of trust holder sues Mr. Peterson for the $2
million, right.
and time passes, he doesn't pay, and so the second deed of trust holder goes ahead with a foreclosure sale. And the complaint was just like this one, where it included a saying that said, if there's a foreclosure sale, I'm going to seek the difference between the fair market value, et cetera.
Right.
Under the statute, the 4639 statute, is anything more required?
I believe so, because it says you have to file a claim, and a claim imports that you provide facts and contextual information concerning what it is you're suing about, not just, you know, I have a second and someday I'm going to do a foreclosure and then after that we'll see what happens. I mean, that's what the complaint basically says here, and I think they were obligated to either file a summary judgment within the 6 months or amend the complaint to give us the information about what happened.
So, but I'm using the language in 4639, it just says a civil action not barred by these statutes may only be commenced within 6 months after the date of the foreclosure sale.
Well,
so it establishes an outside limit, but it doesn't seem to me to say that it must be, unless you're prepared to say you've got to bring a second civil action,
I'm
having
don't
trouble understanding how that would work.
I don't believe you have to file a second action, but I do believe you've got to amend your complaint or make a motion for summary judgment, because if you look at the history of the statute, the regarding the second deed of trust and why they shortened it to 6 months from 6 years
yeah.
is the legislature was concerned with the idea that we've got these people out there and a note holder just lets time go by until...
Oh, I understand the policy. I'm okay. just trying to deal with the wording of the statute.
Right. The statute does not give an abundant amount of information. I got to agree to that.
I mean,
455 seems to be much clearer, but...
I really admire the effort of the lawyers in these cases because you're struggling with an interpretation problem and
exactly.
you're trying to match that up with the practicality of having adequate notice to deal
right.
with either the prosecution or the defense of a given case. But it is interesting that the use of the word application was a key to the Walters decision.
Right.
And it was also critical in the analysis in Labby.
Right.
And when the legislature in 2015 essentially amended or reversed Labby by statute, it used civil action as it had used in 4639.
Right.
So this may be one of those rare cases where the legislature actually used words that they intended to use. You don't have to respond to that, Mr. McKnight. It's just rhetorical observation.
There's really no guidance.
Yeah.
The statutes are difficult. And
yeah.
Is
there anything else you wanted to offer?
Yes,
or,
I would like
thank
to
you.
Comment on the stipulation. Stipulations are the lifeblood of the courts. The courts are always urging the parties, oh, stipulate, do as much as you can to stipulate the facts. And I do believe counsel is reading into this stipulation much more than it's what's on the face of it. The face of it just says, okay.
I think your point is don't use stipulation to form the basis for an application within a six-month period.
Right.
That argument's very clear.
Ever have counsel ever make another stipulation.
Right.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Mr. McKnight, for your argument. Mr. Stein, you have
you,
a few minutes here.
I do need to answer a question for yours, so I'm going to unfold that. We start with that this complaint was filed under NRS 4495, which allows a guarantor who waived the one action rule, undisputed in this case, to be sued before a foreclosure. Lobby's application to this case, because there's a junior involved, has the limiting effect. It says that the affirmative defenses within this range of statutes for which 4631 through 4639 are involved, those affirmative defenses can be raised because 4495 says so. In Lobby, the affirmative defense was a party holding the first deed of trust must file an application within 6 months. 4631 for 4639, which is specific to Junior, says civil action. Under Rule 3 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, a civil action must be filed by complaint. A application under the Rules of Civil Procedure, as the majority said in Lobby and stuck to, was that's by motion. It's by motion. So, as a matter of law, Bank of Nevada had to file the complaint because had it not and filed an application, instead, we'd be arguing that, well, application, complaint really may get in court.
But to Mr. McKnight's point, let's assume for the moment that a junior lien holder files a pre-foreclosure complaint. Does 4639 require an amendment to that complaint once the foreclosure has occurred so that the guarantor knows what precisely is being sought?
No.
Have the facts changed, compelling an amended complaint?
No, for at least four reasons. First, it would be an idle and unnecessary act to file a motion to amend the complaint under Rule 15 to assert the exact words that are in the complaint. The complaint, which paragraph 53 that we discussed earlier, that language did not come from 4455, as Mr. McKnight incorrectly stated. It came from 4495, the statute we sued under. But that statute provides the court instructions what to do if, before that order, which might have already been signed by the judge, hasn't yet been entered by the court. You have to come back and just make sure that that borrower is getting their full credit in case the property sold for more. The language in that complaint was exactly out of 4495. So amending the complaint would have been an utterly useless act. It would exalt form over substance. And possibly most important, Mr. McKnight admitted at the district court level that there would be no need to file an amended complaint if it was a complaint that was needed in the first place. But under 44631 through 4639, the junior, which Bank of Nevada was, had to. And I say, and as I stated earlier, even if we weren't a junior, the concerns in Lobby were all met from every step well before the 6 months. And we're not saying that a stipulation is the same as a as an application or a motion. What we're saying is it would render that moot once it was agreed. There's no new thing to put the lodger on notice of, especially since they were put on notice from the day they were served the complaint that the foreclosure could come and this is what we will be asking for. And
but his point is, why not move for summary judgment once you had the stipulated amount?
We did. We filed within 30 days.
But that was outside the 6 months.
That's true. But there's no need, there's no requirement to file an application under 40 if you're a junior. Now, it is true. Initially, when this was being litigated, these kind of disputes weren't up, but Lobby hadn't been issued yet. And at the same time, when we did file the summary judgment, Lobby was not a published opinion. He cited an unpublished opinion, and the judge went with it. So we had a look at it. The result's the same, whether we're the junior or whether we're a junior using the language in 4455 or 4631 through 39. The net result was the same in the methodology. But it all became moot when there was the stipulation. We weren't going to be looking at the foreclosure price. Before then, we agreed. So foreclosure already happened, but no one's looking at that because this guarantor got the benefit of a higher number. And he knew that by stipulation. So all the concerns of Lobby about being put on notice what you might owe were gone. Thank you, Justices.
I don't have any other questions to my colleagues. All right, thank you, Mr. Stein, Mr. McKnight. Thank you for your excellent arguments today. This concludes this morning's oral argument. I noticed that